Hello, it's time for Raw Storytelling, a podcast where real people share unscripted and uncensored real stories, and I'm your host, Enid Nolasco.
Hello. How have you been? Have you been cooped up during Corona times? Have you been working? Are you somewhere in the middle? I want to know how you've been. So I have big news. You know those little things we call too raw to share? People usually fill them out during the live shows, and they write a secret on a little square piece of paper, and I read the really good ones on stage or post them on social media. So since we're kind of all cooped up and we are not having live shows for the foreseeable future, I have set up a Too Raw to Share hotline. You can call in and leave a voicemail with your secret. Isn't that amazingly fun and awesome? So basically you can share a secret from the past or the present. It doesn't matter. It's completely anonymous. Do not leave your name on there. And we'll play the really good juicy secrets on this podcast. I don't know yet if I'm going to sprinkle them in through our normal long format stories or if I'm going to do a full episode just with secrets. We'll see where that goes. But for now, definitely call in and leave your secret. The number to call is 786-361-6112. That's 786-361-6112. And if you're like, I have a secret, but I'm afraid to share it with my own voice and have my voice heard, I have you covered. You can go to rawstorytelling.org/too-raw. That's T-O-O-R-A-W. And you'll see a little form where you can fill in your secret anonymously on there as well. So leave me your secrets and we'll do good things with them, really fun things with them. Also, big news, I'm just giving a ton of big news at the beginning of this episode. This is fun. We have a book out, a book of poetry. So back in March and April of 2019, we had our first Raw Storytelling Poetry Writing Workshop. And from that workshop, we created a book of poetry. We took the poems that resulted out of these 8 weeks and we turned it into a book. And you can buy that book now at rawstorytelling.org/shop. It's also on Amazon and the book is called Grammatical Siblings, a book of poetry by Ryan Beinack, Alex Obed, Sandy Silla, and yours truly, Enid Nolasco. It is a really, really, really fun read. It's super light. It's a small, light book, and it's great. The cover is designed by me, so it looks great on your bookshelf. And also, it's just a fun little read, especially during these times when you don't know what else to do. It's a really fun afternoon read with spunky little poems by us punk poets. So on today's episode, we have three stories from our live show recorded in May 2019. The theme was lies. This show was so good. We actually had 5 storytellers and we're splitting it up into 2 parts. So we have lies part 1 now in May and we're going to have lies part 2 in our July episode. Okay, let's start the show.
Terry Hart is a human rights activist who is silly enough to think she can still change the world one story at a time, and her story is titled Next Level.
So what Enid did not share with you is that I'm not quite certain that the statute of limitations has passed on my story. So I come to you bearing my full lie under the lights. I don't know how many of you are keeping track of the number of lies that are coming out of the White House. Do we know how many? A lot. I think we're nearing almost 11,000. But it was one of his earlier lies that really set me off. They all set me off, but it was his early lie about the size, the very, very large size of his inauguration crowd. And I knew this to be a lie because I knew who held that honor. And that honor belonged to President Barack Obama in 2009. And I know that because I was there. The city of DC had never been so excited. I had interned there as a law student in the late 1990s. Never before had I seen such excitement. It was pumping. I was pumping. DC was on fire. The city had already exceeded its maximum capacity by 6 a.m. on Inauguration Day. And I'm not kidding. Metros were stopped, trains were stopped, escalators stopped, no cabs in town, buses full, and most of us had been traveling for 2 days to get there. People from all over the world were talking on the metro of how excited they were to witness this moment in history. We were all swapping stories with how far we'd come. I thought I was special because I had come from Denver, and then I spoke to the folks from Africa next to me, and I realized I was not so special. That's not the first time in this story that I would have that realization. But I could tell something was wrong because usually DC metros are pretty on time. And we were standing at our platform and nothing was moving. And there were thousands and thousands of people and we were stuck. And people were getting antsy because the longer we sat there, the more that we knew that we would miss the magic that we had come to see. Now, I had put in my time as a volunteer. I didn't have the $2,000 that it took to make it into the inauguration ball, but I had put in about 10,000 hours of volunteer time to register people to vote, to get people engaged, to educate them on the issues. I just wanted people to participate, to feel like they had a voice, to feel engaged. So a lot of my friends just assumed that I was going to the inauguration, and I didn't even really know what an inauguration was. So I got the feel for it, and people started calling me and saying, I have tickets, I have tickets, I can help you out. So I got some tickets. I got a VIP ticket for the We Are the One concert on the Lincoln Memorial Mall. It was a free concert. You didn't really need VIP tickets. But we got to stand in a little cattle pen and feel special, very special. But I did feel special. Sheryl Crow was there, Usher, the boss, Stevie Wonder, James Taylor, Beyonce, how could I miss Beyonce? It was incredible. They all wore white as a statement of solidarity in their beautiful suits. It was one of the coldest days on record in DC. Record high turnout, record low temperatures. So back to that metro platform. The day of the inauguration. I've been waiting for 6 hours to get there, 2 hours early for the swearing in. The trains were not moving. The Metro Police came in over the loudspeaker. Can you help us? We have stopped the trains because someone has fallen on the tracks. Can you help us? Someone is having a heart attack on the escalator. We need your patience. Can you help us? Well, what does an Obama crowd do? They began chanting, yes, we can. Yes, we can. I started to cry. I was losing my mind. I knew I was going to miss the inauguration, but I was so moved by the act of public civility. Remember those days? Public civility. There were thousands of people trapped in the DC metro being polite to one another. This does not happen. I ride the metro in every city, in every country. This does not happen. They were chanting, yes, we can. Some people dropped to their knees to pray for the person on the escalator who was having the heart attack. Other people started praying over the tracks so that the people who were on the tracks could be pulled from the tracks. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. What felt like hours later, but was probably about 45 minutes, we were released from the underground, and we walked up those escalators into the light. And sure as hell, didn't they lock us out of the inauguration. So our special VIP tickets, the event was free. But just like Economy Plus, you know, we were one row ahead of the next guy. And we were special. But we were locked out now because you had to enter 2 hours early. So once again, cold, frustrated, feeling like a commoner, I found a cafe and tried to warm up. Without a TV or radio, I heard nothing of the inauguration. I was devastated. My friend from California, who had taken a different route, was inside our VIP section, and she was livid that I had missed, like as if I had some control over the course of events leading up to this. So she finally finds me at the cafe hours later and starts ripping me a new one. And I began to practice the pacifist language and the nonviolent communication that I'd begun to learn. She had red hair, and I believed that perhaps she was on fire at this moment because she was angrier than normal. And I said, why don't we just figure out how we're going to get into that ball? So I just changed the direction of her energy. No sooner do I utter those words than a very tall, dark-haired, handsome man, perfectly groomed, sits down next to us at Kramer Books, opens his breast pocket, and takes out 5 tickets to the inaugural ball. Each of those tickets were at least $2,000, possibly more. And he lays them down on the table like a full house. The arrogance. They were inches from our hands. We could have grabbed them and run out the door, and I think we would have beat him. I looked him in the eyes and said, sir, by chance, are you going to the inauguration? Are you going to the ball this evening? Why, yes. How did you know? I can see your tickets. Might you have an extra one for a volunteer from California and a volunteer from Colorado who have worked more than 10,000 hours and have likely registered more than 5,000 voters combined? I'll have to think about it. My girlfriend and I started doing a mind meld. We just stared into each other's eyes. Your husband's a Methodist pastor, he would not approve. You're not that desperate, you won't do it. I have a large portfolio of shame, but I felt that at this point in my life, becoming an escort was not going to be I was not going to include that in my portfolio. Now, this gentleman was not inviting that, but the silence and his stare seemed to be insinuating that something else could be arranged. Well, we decided on this special occasion that we would not change our moral compass, and we quickly got up and left, not to tempt our fate. As there were no hotel rooms, because again, DC was sold out the day after the elections for their hotel rooms, we crashed at a friend's place, tired, cold, and defeated. I took a hot shower and I said, put your game face on, Red, put it on. We're gonna get into that ball. She said, what's your plan? I said, I have no plan, but we are getting into that ball. Follow me. I don't know what I was saying. I don't know, I was just losing my mind. We make it up to the convention center with the thousands and thousands of other people. Now, the Obamas are so inclusive that they had 12 separate inaugural balls, 12. And as we got closer to the convention center, it was as if there was a Harry Potter moment. And there was some type of invisibility cloak that covered the two of us. And I'm not kidding you, out of nowhere, hundreds of men with black raincoats looking like Secret Service, to this day, I don't know who they are, where they came from, or where they went, surrounded us, and we were like in the middle of a rugby circle, and we just were moved past the first checkpoint. Our feet were not touching the ground. We were pinned in a crowd, moving with these raincoat people. It was a Harry Potter moment, and I'm not even a Harry Potter fan. I don't know how it happened. But these men basically shepherded us past the first checkpoint, which we didn't even know existed. At the second checkpoint, when they asked for our tickets, I said, "Sir, our friends are inside, and they have tickets." Now, if you listen to what I said, it was not exactly a lie. We did have friends inside, and they did have tickets. Their tickets were not our tickets, and we had not established that they had extra tickets, but it was clever enough for him to set us aside as the rest of the herd of cattle made their way towards the convention center. And we stood there for 20 minutes with our flip phones, pretending to call friends who were inside and ask for their tickets. No one answered. My friend, who up until this time thought I was insane, it began to spread. And she said, "Just start walking now." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" She said, "They left. They're not paying attention to us. Just start walking now." So now I'm following this angry redhead on a mission. And she turns into Spidey. And we're just jumping gates and going. We're in our 30s. I mean, this, we are not 16. I mean, I was a pool hopper back in the day. But this is next level. This is next level. We make it to the next point, and there are some rather large, bald men whose biceps are bigger than my legs. They stop us and start with the wand, the metal detector, the patting you down, the going through your purse. And they got a little suspicious because in our purse were our dresses. We weren't dressed because we never thought we were going to get in. So we had these long coats on, but our ball gowns were wrapped up in what appeared to be a beach bag. And the guy just looked at us and he was like, "Whatever. Go ahead." We are now up to our third checkpoint. Again, we had no idea that we would make it this far. We enter the convention center and we think we are in. We are so psyched. Well, who the hell do you think walks by us? Mr. Tall, Dark, and Handsome. Mm-hmm. Walks right by. He does a double take, we do a double take. And I said to my friend, if we start begging to him now, somebody's going to find out that we don't belong here, because it's clear we don't belong here because we have sneakers on. So we decided to follow him because we thought that he knew what he was doing. And he stopped the coat check, but that was problem number one. We couldn't give our coats away because we weren't wearing the proper attire. We followed him to what became the Southwestern Ball. We were choosing between California and New York because we had friends there, but we figured those would be too crowded and the security would be too great. So we followed him into the Southwestern Ball, where both of us had once lived in Colorado. Our final checkpoint was six people wide, and it was an airport-like terminal. And there was one poor woman trying to process the thousands of people all entering at once into the Southwestern Ball. I told my friend, "Hold up your We Are the One VIP ticket." She said, "What?" I said, "Hold up your We Are the One volunteer ticket. Hold it up." So we hold up this ticket and we just keep walking. Just keep walking. I said, "Use the force. Work with me here. Use the force, Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan to be inside." I was desperate. We lost our minds. We were out of our minds. We were Obama-like crazy. The woman looks at us, her little razor, you know, that little red laser on your barcode, and we just keep walking. She looks at us, makes eye contact. "I know your tickets are illegitimate. I don't have time to deal with you. You do not appear to be a threat. If you become a threat later, I'm on to you." That was good enough for me. We pop out of that chute. I fall into the arms of the governor of Colorado. Fall into the arms. He's a very kind man. I've met him a few times. He pretended like he knew me, like I was a dear friend of his. "Hi! Welcome to the Southwestern Ball. Aren't you excited to be here?" I'm just shaking. And I'm still in my sneakers with my trench coat. So at this point, I could very easily be the Unabomber. I look like an idiot. I look like a complete idiot. We run into the bathroom, and it was just like prom night. We lock ourselves in a stall. We start shaking from what we had just accomplished. We're crying, we're laughing, we're on the floor. We are grown women in the girls' room putting on our prom gowns like idiots. We come out, and just like prom, it was more hype than it really deserved. Because the volunteers who had done all the work weren't really in that room. But we did pass the Joe Biden smell test. He came by, sniffed our hair, gave us a massage, moved on. Barack and Michelle, they did their beautiful dance in all their elegance. And just like Cinderella, we knew we had to make it home by midnight because the last train was going and there was not a cab to be found for two broads who were as stupid as we were. As we raced to that last midnight train, I literally body blocked Stevie Wonder. I just came running around a corner. I was on the ground, he was still standing, he never saw it coming. Stevie, I'm so sorry, you were great last night, thank you so much for the concert, I'm so sorry, I'm an idiot, I'm not gonna tell you your name. And then Sheryl Crow walks by singing, "It's My Favorite Mistake." We hopped onto that train and said, "Yes, we can."
Hey, yo, Luke, you ready, man?
Yeah, man, I'm ready to go, Big Will.
Come on, let's do this thing.
You're gonna do this thing.
I'm gonna do this thing.
You're gonna do this thing.
I'm gonna do this thing.
You're gonna do this thing.
I'm gonna do this thing.
Come on, get up and let's do this thing.
If you love Raw Storytelling, and you should, rate and review us on iTunes, tell a friend, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Raw Storytelling, and donate. We are a community-driven project, and every little bit helps, even a dollar. You can donate at rawstorytelling.org/donate. Or you can also buy our merch, the book that I just mentioned, our poetry book called Grammatical Siblings that just came out, our t-shirts, our pins, or you can hire me as a storytelling coach. All of this information is on the site at rawstorytelling.org. And if you have any questions, you can reach out to me directly at Enid, that's E-N-I-D, at rawstorytelling.org. Most of these women are bugging, girl, it's only you and nothing, I can see it, and I don't say it to make you conceited, I mean it, you're the one I wanna be with, please believe it, I was gone for a minute, but I'm back for something steady, so if you ain't, could you tell your friends, cause I'm ready, you gonna do this thing, I'm gonna do this thing, you gonna do this thing, I'm gonna do this thing, you gonna do this thing, I'm gonna do this thing, well, come on, get up and let's do this thing.
Our next storyteller is Dawn Ellicott Klinkscale, and she's a licensed marriage and family therapist who is writing her first novel entitled Vicarious Trauma, and the title of her story is titled The Lies We Tell Ourselves. So, Dawn, where are you? There you are.
So I'd like to begin my story with a quote from one of my favorite authors, Maya Angelou. I'd like to be known as an intelligent woman, a courageous woman, a loving woman, a woman who teaches by being. And I felt like I needed to start my story with that quote because the story I'm about to tell you may cause you to question not just my intelligence, but my very sanity. So my story begins in 1990, or maybe it was 91. I was pregnant with my third child, or had just given birth to him. The truth is, I can't remember the details very well because the incident that happened to me was so traumatizing that I actually buried it in my memory for almost 25 years. So I'm gonna go back a few years. The year was 1983. I was sweet, 17, and I'd hardly ever been kissed. Well, maybe I'd been kissed a few times, but that's neither here nor there. The point was I was sweet and I was young and I had my whole life ahead of me. I arrived on the campus of Anderson University in the quaint Midwestern town of Anderson, Indiana, and I was a freshman in college, and I got there freshman orientation week before all the other upperclassmen got there. I had been recruited by a few friends of mine who'd gone to my church, and they told me it'd be a great place for me to get a good Christian education. I'd be surrounded by all these Christians who would just love me and pray with me, and it was just going to be a wonderful time in the Lord if I went there. And I got to tell you, when I got on campus, even though I was all alone, I met some of the nicest people from all over the country that I could hope to meet. And people at this small Christian college in this quaint Midwestern town were just as nice as you would think they would be. Except for this one guy. He was arrogant and abrasive and obnoxious and argumentative, and he was always playing the devil advocate. But there was just something about him. I don't know what it was. I mean, sure, he looked a little bit like Wynton Marsalis, you know, that jazz musician and that artist. He looked a little bit like him, and in truth, he sang in a way that just, if you would listen to his voice, you could hear the angels weep as he sang. And even as you got to know him in smaller groups and smaller circles, when you catch him in an odd moment, if you looked into his eyes, you could see this deep sorrow and sadness. And you realize that all that abrasiveness and argumentativeness was really just a facade to cover up some deep hurt that he was hiding on the inside. So I became curious. Somehow, even back then, something about me was like leaning toward being a counselor or a therapist. So I was curious and I wanted to get to know him better. So when we had the opportunity sitting around, you know, in the student cafes and talking over coffee or donuts or whatever we were doing, he started telling me a little bit about his history, his background. I found out he was actually very intelligent, well-read for a young man his age, and that he actually had a lot of really good ideas. After we got to know each other even a few months more, he started to tell me the story of his childhood, which had been quite abusive and had quite a bit of trauma. And that is when I think I told myself the first lie. The lie that went like something like this, and some of you other women have heard this one, and maybe you've told it to yourself, that love conquers all. And my love can heal his soul. I told myself that. And so, exactly. So within a few months, actually in a few months after that, we got engaged. And we told our friends and our family about it. And of course, some people tried to talk us out of it, but people were surprisingly supportive. Because if you go to a small Christian college in the 80s, there's lots of marriage couple there. People encourage you to get married because, of course, it's better to marry than to burn. Know what I'm talking about? So there was not that much resistance. And then I talked to his mom on the phone one time, and she was just so happy for us that she actually paid for our engagement ring. And then she helped buy the fabrics that I would go on to use to make the T-length princess wedding dress that I made for myself. So it was just so beautiful. And of course, us not having any sense of money or anything, we decided that what we needed to do before we got married is to join this Europe choir. So both of us tried up for the choir, and we ended up taking a pre-honeymoon trip for only $450. And we traveled all over Europe. We sang in the cathedrals. We took a cruise on the Rhine River. We went through the Black Forest. We even got to see the Berlin Wall. For those of you who don't know what that is, ask your parents, okay? They've torn it down since then. But we saw the Berlin Wall. It was wonderful. And when we got back a week later, my mother had made all the preparations for the wedding, and we got married in a small private ceremony in my family's home. So right after the wedding, we moved back to the college where we would continue to work and go to school. And, you know, we just fell back into the pattern of college life. There were lots of other married couples there, so we'd be doing cute little get-togethers and dinners at our little apartment and all those cute things. And within 9 months of our marriage, I conceived and brought forth a son, and we called him David. He was 6 pounds, 13 ounces, just the most beautiful baby boy you could ever see. Well, of course, young women are very fertile. So by the time David was 9 months old, I conceived and brought forth my second child, Jessica. Oh my God, she was so beautiful. She is so beautiful even now. And she had big brown eyes, curly brown hair, and the disposition of an angel. See, unlike some other people, I didn't get postpartum depression. I had postpartum euphoria, and everything was wonderful. Sure, our finances were stretched to the limit, and we didn't have any money. There were times when my husband had to bring home leftovers from the school cafeteria just so we could eat. But we didn't care. We had our love to keep us warm. And it went on like that, and a few years later, he finally graduated from college, and we decided to move back to Columbus, Ohio, where he had been born. And we started going to what was going to be a burgeoning megachurch. And my husband, he had gotten his degree, I think it was in professional staff ministries, whatever the hell that is. I don't know what that is, but it was professional staff ministries. And he became pastor over the youth group. I mean, he was 25, so he was this cool, hip youth pastor. And I was there, and I was doing vacation Bible school. He revamped the worship team. This was when worship teams were just starting to get cool, if you guys know what I'm talking about. So it was like he revamped it, and I mean, we were just like, with your urban power Christian couple at 25 and 26 years old. And things were just going around, and everybody loved our kids. They were so sweet. Things were going along beautifully until one day my husband asked me to come into the bathroom. He said that he went to the bathroom and he saw blood in his urine, and then it was kind of burning. And I thought to myself, well, he could have like a UTI, or, you know, sometimes you can pass yeast infections back and forth. And so we said, well, just go to the doctor. Of course, our finances were stretched thin. We were on the getting free health care through the system, so we had to go to the free clinic. So he goes in there. I go run some errands and come back and pick him up. And he comes in the car, and he has a sick look on his face. And I said, well, what's wrong? And he said, they said it's chlamydia. And I said, what? I said, these people are so incompetent. What is wrong with them? I hate having to be free clinic. I can't wait till you get some good insurance and we can go to a real doctor and we don't have to deal with this kind of incompetence anymore. So they gave him, they said you need to be tested too. I said, well, I don't need to be tested. These people don't even know what they're talking about. I don't have time to waste for that. I've got all these kids to take care of. Again, I was either pregnant with my third child or just had him. I actually don't remember. But we had too many things to do to worry about that. So he took the antibiotics and cleared it up. If it was a UTI, that would have cleared it up. If it was a yeast infection, it would have cleared it up. Either way, it was going to clear up whatever it was. And I forgot all about the incident. We went on, and the church grew, and he became more popular. He was going to other churches, traveling around to different states. And I literally forgot all about the incident. And until one day, about 7 years later, I got a phone call from someone in church, and she said, I just had sex with your husband. And I said, I'm so sorry to hear that. I'm going to pray for both of you. And I hung up. And I told him, somebody called here. You know, these women at the church are so petty and so jealous, and they're always trying to get involved in our relationship. And I just tried to brush it off and as somebody trying to interfere. Because, you know, if any of you have been to a big church where your spouse is in limelight, there are always people trying to figure out how they can get close to them. So I was used to this. I had been warned about this. And I just tried to sweep it under the rug. But then I noticed that he started making phone calls late at night. He would kind of sneak out of bed. I don't feel like going to sleep. I'm going to go watch some TV upstairs. He would go watch TV, and this is back in the day when you had landlines. If you don't know what a landline is, you can ask your grandparents. So we had landlines. So there was one night I remember realizing that he had gone upstairs, and I kind of heard a voice that didn't sound like a television, so I did that little trick. Some of you might remember where you pick up the phone, but you put your finger on the thing so they can't hear that you're there. And I just kind of listened in, and it was a woman's voice. And so after he had the whole conversation, I wait till he comes downstairs, and I said, why is Sister so-and-so calling you at 11:45 at night? Why are you guys talking on the phone? Oh, she just wanted to talk about blah, 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 fill in the blank. And I said, well, there's absolutely no reason. You know, I threw a little hissy fit. He said, why are you so petty? You don't have to be jealous. Anybody heard that before? Anybody been told, don't be petty, don't be jealous. It must be you. There's something wrong with you. And I felt so embarrassed that I would even think anything like that. I see you smiling. Even in the dark, I see that smile. And so I tried to ignore it as long as I could, but then the gossip started around the church. And by that time, my youngest son was 7 years old, and I had started working full-time. I'd been working full-time for a few years, and I had kind of come into my own a little more. And I decided to kind of confront my husband about some of the things I was hearing. And this was the September before our 10th anniversary. A lot of our friends were preparing for their 10th anniversaries, and I was wondering if we were going to do anything, and I knew finances were tight. And then he decided that he was going to confess that he had been having an affair with one of the women he had been volunteering with the youth with the church. And I knew that something was going on. Anybody ever know something's going on, you know, anything? But I couldn't believe it. It was just so inconceivable that I couldn't believe it. And so we decided to get some counseling, and we're going to revamp our life. He resigned from the youth pastorate, and he sat down from a couple of the other ministries, sort of changed our schedules around some, and for the next 3 years, we tried to save our marriage. Instead of our marriage being saved, more hostility grew and more anger and resentment, and a lot of the stuff that we had been sort of ignoring from the past that sort of carried over into our marriage kind of spilled over. And at about year 12, we decided that we had to get a divorce, well, that we should go ahead and separate. And I remember telling him that we were, by that point I was 32, that most people don't even get married till 32 anymore, and I had been married a long time by that point. And, yeah, like an old woman at that point. And we decided that we were young enough that we should give each other a chance to see if we could be happy. And so throughout that period, I realized that there were many times when I lied to myself, when I wasn't true to myself, when I didn't trust my own instincts. And I realized that that wasn't something that he had done to me. That was something I had done to myself. And so I've learned through the years as I'm telling my story today, and I've actually shared it with a couple other people, because there's so many women that I work with as a counselor who I found out have told the same lie to themselves, the same lies over and over for some of the really same good reasons, because they love their husbands, they love their families, they love their children. And I, you know, the biggest lie I think I told myself is that you bury your head in the sand, that your problems would just go away. But in truth, if you bury your head in the sand, you'll probably just suffocate and die. Thank you.
So our last storyteller, his story is titled Lives Picadillos. And I love it because his intro is literally just Derek. So just Derek, come on up here.
So I was talking with a friend of mine recently, and we were talking about stories. And the more stories you have in your life, the more colorful you have as a memories in your life. So I want my quilt to be as colorful as possible with all the stories I can think of. And someone reminded me of a story the other day. I was raised in Ireland. I was raised in Dublin. And on the south side of Dublin are the Wicklow Mountains. And there's some, these various peaks you got to go across to go from where I was raised to where I went to school to where a friend of mine lived. And this one particular night, about 3 in the morning, I'm about 18 years old, I got this real nice fast motorcycle to take that ride across the mountains. Now, I knew these roads well. I knew these roads well because from the age of 14 to 18, I used to go to school every day up and down that mountain. I would come down on my bicycle, I'd be all the way down, fast as I could. Now, I had a motorcycle, I could really haul ass. Now, this thing is at 3 in the morning. It is pitch black. It's Ireland. There's no light pollution. There's no moon out that night. It is black as black can be. And I'm heading so fast down this road through this tunnel of light. I'm able to see if there's a car coming because, you know, it's light coming the other way. No, it's black. So I'm cruising down this thing, brushing off one shoulder, brushing off the other shoulder. I'm loving life. My heart is slowed down. It's like a meditation at this point. I'm loving every second of this thing. But there comes to a section at the bottom of the road where it widens out as you go down to the valley and come up the other side. And on this section of road, when it gets wide, there's a couple of houses down the one side, a couple of houses down the other. The road widens up where cars can park. And down further again, it goes back into the darkness, back in where there's no more street lights. And I'm looking for that bit where I go through the light and then whoop, into that tunnel again. It's the most beautiful feeling. This particular night, though, things were just a little bit different. There was a Volkswagen minibus parked on the left-hand side. Now, that thing, the lights didn't come on. I couldn't see if there was a cab light come on inside of it. I couldn't see the brake lights come on, so there was no one inside of it. I figured, hey, no problem. So I keep going through the gears, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour. I'm going, I can't wait for that tunnel. It's going to be epic again, leaning this way, leaning that way. But right as I get to that minivan, pulled right out in front of me, I went right through that thing. I'm like, hold on a second. Is this what happens when you die? What if, just like that, everything stops? If your body is separated from your soul, if your body is separated from your spirit that quickly, would you know? Would you still be a spirit for a while? I'm on the bike. Am I dead or alive? Did that just happen? Holy shit. So I look back behind me and I see the minivan across the road. I can't see if creamed on the other side of it is old Derek, you know, mushed into the back of that thing. I can't tell. I'm kind of in shock here. So I keep going. Now, am I lying to myself here? Am I still alive? How do I know if I'm truly alive? I'm not going back there. I don't really want to know. I'm going to ride this thing for a while. So I keep going the rest of the way. I'm like, hey, I'm kind of invincible. This is good. I can get away with anything. Whether I'm dead or alive, there's no one out here. Who can tell? So I'm like, okay, pinch myself. That shit don't work, right? So I keep going home, and I'm on autopilot at this point. So I get home. No one's up. It's 3 in the morning. I get no one who can really talk to. Go to bed. I slept pretty well that night. I don't know what was going on. But the next morning when I got up, okay, I can ask some people. No, the house is empty because I went to bed at 3. I'm not up till, like, you know, 12 o'clock the next day. So I'm going around the house. No one is around. Well, we all have this thing called the reticular activating system. This is a thing that our brain does where we block out data that our brain thinks we don't need to have. It's like when you buy a new car and all of a sudden everyone's got that car. How come I didn't notice so many of these cars on the road before? That's your brain blocking shit out. So I get up the next day and I'm walking around and I'm going down around the neighborhood and it seems different. But is it because I'm looking at it now differently? Is it because I'm just now using different parts of my brain to see what's going on, or am I fucking dead? Okay? Did this really happen? Am I really a spirit? Is this a ghost? I'm supposed to die at 70 years old, but now I'm 18. I went before my time. I'm going to be walking the world for a while now. Is this it? It's very lonely. Where is everybody, right? So I think, okay, I got to figure this shit out, man. I had this brainwave of an idea. I'm going to stand in front of the mirror and interview myself. Hey, man, you alive? How you doing? Prove to me that shit actually happened. Prove to me that shit didn't happen, right? So I started looking up, okay, what are tells? What are tells? How you know if someone is lying? Well, one way you know that someone is lying is they raise their voice. I swear to God, I was at the gym. I didn't go to her house. You know, like, no. Okay, so raising the voice is one tell. Another tell is where people start giving you all kinds of extra data. Data is not really relevant to what's going on, you know. Did you steal that cookie? Well, you know, I came in the kitchen and then I saw the thing on the TV. Did you take the cookie? Right, all this extra data. Then there's where people jump from the first person to the third person. Yeah, it wasn't me. It was that guy over there. I swear to God, I saw him hanging around lurking. That guy, I couldn't trust that guy, right? Third person. All right, so I'm looking out for that one. And then there are people who will say things with their mouth that they're saying different. You know, I love you, honey, right? They're saying no, but they're saying yeah. Which one is it? Yeah. And then there's the woulda, coulda, shoulda, maybe. I mean, here's an interesting fun fact. In the Asian language, and I'm not sure which one, so don't quote me on this one, but you can't say, I would have done something, I could have done something, I should have done something. You either fucking did it or you did not do it. Right? So that's another one you're going to look for. So then there's another one where people start saying the same thing over and over and over again. I came in there. It wasn't there when I came in. Oops. It wasn't there when I came in. I came in the door. It was right there. And then this happened. But I tell you, I just came in the door and it wasn't there, right? So it's that repeating stuff over and over again. How about invoking God? I swear to God, man, it wasn't me. Swear to God. And then there's those people who turn around and they'll say, I'm as honest as the day is long, frankly speaking, to be honest here, you know, right? Another liar, man. And then there's the ones who dress up a lie. I swear to God, that contract will be finished in 2 weeks. You got my word on it. Swear to God, right? So there I am. I go to the mirror and I say, okay, let's see how many tells I can spot in myself, you know? So I say, so, you alive? You dead? Tell me, Derek, you alive or dead? What's the story? Did it actually happen? Are you here? How do you know you're not a ghost? I know I'm here, man. I'm alive. Hey, you know, there, I'm getting loud. Shit. I busted my own shit already. Look, man, I was going down the street, and this was happening, that was happening. There comes the data. If it wasn't me, it was the guy in the van. Shit, there's the third person. Well, I would have been able to prove I was alive if only people were here. Now it's all getting out of control. So I figured, okay, there's a cluster of lies happening here. Swear to God, it wasn't me. I know I made it home. So I thought to myself, all right, if I'm actually dead, if I'm actually living a dream, then I can do anything. I can get away with murder here, as it were. So if I can basically do anything, and I'm not going to fail, I could fly. I could say hello to somebody, they'll say hello back. I can decide I'm going to do that thing or that thing or that thing. I can do any damn thing, because in a dream, you can't fail. I got another 40, 50, 60 years of this shit. I can just walk around the planet doing whatever the hell I want to do. So what I do? I bought a bigger motorcycle. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And I took that thing and I traveled all over Europe. I had a blast. I visited lots of countries. I lived in lots of countries. I had a great time. I met tons of people. I mean, here I am now in front of all you folks. Long way from home. But it always feels like home because I didn't leave, right? You can do anything you want to do. I've had the most fantastic series of experiences in my life, and they just keep going on and on and on because I lied to myself or I didn't lie to myself. Oddly enough, the idea of lying, let that lie there. So a lie really is something that just persists. So if you get up and do something, then it's not a lie. Then you're actually participating in life. What you focus on expands. What you lean into occurs more and more. So I just kept doing more and more of the things that are full of life. And yet, maybe I'm dead. So where's the contradiction in that? Here's the thing I found out, though. At the end of the day, if you're true to yourself about everything that you do, then truth will keep coming back to you. There's a great thing the Toltec said, be impeccable with your word. If you are really clear and impeccable with everything that you do and everything that you say, then that truth becomes the dream. And well, my dream was kind of a lie. I lied to myself about being alive. And yet, there's the truth. So if I'm going to leave one parting thing, it would be this. If you're the most impeccable with your word that you possibly could be, you'll find that you'll live the dream. And that's no lie.
Something right now. So he kind of refused to tell me his story. I usually hear every story that's shared on this show, unless it's like a last minute thing. Like, I have an open spot. He kind of refused to tell me his story. No lie, probably my favorite story so far. Thank you. Thank you. That's crazy. I had no idea what was going to happen. No idea. I was like, well, we either are going to crash and burn at the end of the show, or we're going to see something amazing, and I'm glad it was the second, right? Thank you. Give him another round of applause. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Nice to meet you, Just Derek.
I don't know when live shows will be back, but we will be doing one podcast episode a month as we've always been doing before. We will keep those going. And eventually we might do a virtual show. Maybe if this lockdown continues for very long, we might do it towards the end of the year. We'll see how it goes. But don't worry, I have a backlog of stories that can last us a year. And also, I really, really want to hear your secrets during these times and share those on the podcast. So I encourage you to definitely go to rawstorytelling.org/2raw and leave me your 2 raw to shares, or call in to the hotline at 786-361-6112 and share your secret on the voicemail. The music you heard in this episode is by Monk Turner from his album Love Story. Of course, this is In Excess playing right now, plus other varied artists featured on our live show recordings. Oh, and if you want to hire me as a brand designer, because let's face it, the Raw Storytelling brand is fucking amazing, see more of my work at therawmade.com. Follow Raw Storytelling at rawstorytelling.org and Raw Storytelling on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you to DJ Sandoz, who recorded the live audio for this episode's stories. Fabiel Lozada is our podcast editor, and Café Collective is our host venue. Okay, until next time, I'm Enid Nolasco. Stay home, stay positive, and stay raw. I've got to let you know.